So our next speaker is Leanne Chrometis, Dr. Leanne Chrometis from Virginia Tech. She's one of the two authors, currently an assistant professor in the Department of Biological Systems Engineering, did her PhD in environmental science and engineering at UNC Gillian School of Public Health. We have a couple alums from that school today. And her current program of research focuses on providing water and sanitation in underserved regions of the U.S., including and particularly in Appalachia.
Thank you. So I'll just start off by saying that I have no relationships to disclose, financial or otherwise. So we just talked, shifting from international to the United States, looking domestically. Where does drinking water come from in the U.S.? For the majority of Americans, it comes from a municipal drinking water treatment plant. So this is a place where surface or groundwater is extracted, it's centrally treated, and then it's put into a distribution system that goes throughout the community. Since we're all here at a public health conference, we know that this is considered one of the great achievements of public health in the 20th century in the United States. This is a classical graph. I just pulled it off the US CDC website, showing that when we began centrally treating our drinking water, so things like chlorination, also filtration, we saw a dramatic decrease in waterborne disease incidence. So things like typhoid and cholera became essentially unknown in the United States. And realizing that this has been such a critical, you know, protector of the public health, we have certain regulations that go to protect our drinking water quality. Most particularly the 1974 U.S. Safe Drinking Water Act. This mandates certain monitoring requirements for drinking water treatment plants. It also sets contaminant levels to ensure that, to minimize exposure amongst those who are being served. However, and I find that a lot of people know this, but they might not be aware, might not think about it, is that 10 to 15% of Americans actually use a private drinking water supply system. And this is operationally defined as a system that serves less than 25 individuals for at least 60 days per year, so not a totally transient system, and has less than 15 service connections. And by definition, this is not subject to the Safe Drinking Water Act. So that means that all maintenance, monitoring is the private homeowner's responsibility. So examples you're probably most familiar with, a well. So you could have a drilled well or a bored well. People also use springs, and these can be improved springs with a spring box. Also, perhaps lesser kind of thought of are cisterns. There are people who are reliant on rainwater cisterns in parts of the United States. Cisterns are basically a big storage tank that can be also used to store groundwater for times of drought or actually trucked in water. So perhaps not surprisingly, given that there's no kind of oversight of these systems, it's just relying on the homeowners, and these are typically in rural areas. The most recent report by the Centers for Disease Control stated that about a third of waterborne disease outbreaks associated with drinking water in the past 30 to 40 years were associated with untreated groundwater systems. So these systems are kind of garnering a little bit more attention as a potential public health concern. So where is this contamination coming from? I mean, we're in the developed world. So if you look at this cartoon, I've got my little house and my well. You have several different kind of classes of pollutants, and it's kind of important when you're considering treatment and incidence to know where things are coming from. So there are geologic and background conditions that can give rise to things that we would regard as contaminants, as having an adverse effect. And this is just a function of the soil and the geology of the aquifer. So you can have too much, or you could actually have too little fluoride. You could have high levels of sodium. You can also have anthropogenic sources of contamination. So we can also call these surface sources. So the most common is that if you have a private drinking water supply system, you probably also have on-site wastewater treatment, which is something like a septic system. If your septic system is not properly sited, if you have insufficient soils for treatment, or you're not maintaining it and so it fails, your drain field can actually leach into the groundwater, and so that can be a source of contamination. Our adorable little cow and dog here represent potential agricultural or other domestic animals that, you know, surface supply waste. You can also have fertilizer requirements. All of these things, depending on the saturation of your soil and how you protect your well, can leach in and become part of the source water. And finally, there's a third class. Once the water enters the home, it's generally fed into a pressure tank or storage tank, and perhaps there's treatment, but it also flows through the on-site plumbing. And so depending on the quality of your water, for instance, if you have very low pH water, it might stimulate corrosion. So then you actually have contamination and metals entering from the on-site plumbing system. And the reason I'm going back into this, in case some of you are like, yeah, that seems to make sense, is because a lot comes down to where we sample these systems. A lot of studies, there aren't many studies of private systems, but if you look at the point of extraction, so if you measure at the wellhead, then you're really only going to capture geological background and some surface contamination. You're not really getting at the risk posed to the consumer, which you get if you sample at the point of use. So there you're taking into account any negative effects of on-site plumbing and also any positive effects from treatment. So before I go any farther, I don't want to insult any well owners here in the audience. I've certainly drank well water. Private water systems are not inherently more dangerous. You can have very high quality and palatable drinking water from these systems. Humans have been using wells and groundwater systems for hundreds of years, so technologically, we know how to construct and maintain these systems. We generally we're concerned with initial siting. You certainly don't want to site downstream from a septic system or any other known contaminant. You need to construct your well properly. You need a casing. You need a proper wellhead. You want to regularly inspect things like your sanitary well cap to make sure that it hasn't been damaged, just doing this periodically, clearing the wellhead from damage, and annual testing. So currently the EPA, and this is something that's put out at the state and the federal level, the EPA recommends testing annually for fecal indicator bacteria because they're considered a primary health concern. And depending on where you live, every 2 to 3 years for nitrate. However, I wouldn't be here if there wasn't some bad news. And the bad news is that most research in this area says that people just do not test their wells and they do not follow these maintenance recommendations. And so my background is actually, I did some international work, I did some general kind of fate and transport of bacteria work, and when I began working in domestic supplies, I was kind of confused by this. Why wouldn't you test your water? In the United States, there's a fair amount of education about how important water is. It's coming out of your tap. Why wouldn't you test your water? And so my first inclination, what I heard from a lot of people was, well, it's just cost, right? It can be, depending on where you go, it can be several hundred dollars to test your water. It's just a cost issue. However, about 3-4 years ago, I read a paper in Journal of Water and Health from Canada. And the interesting thing about Canada, as opposed to the United States, is that in the U.S., it's just the homeowner's responsibility to take care of this situation. In Canada, you can collect a water sample at any time from your tap, if you're on a private drinking water supply, take it to the local health office, and they will test it for you free of charge. So we've really removed the cost barrier. However, in this case, they still found that people did not adhere to the monitoring requirements, and the reason was they didn't perceive a problem. So I won't get into all the technicalities of the different barriers, but the big barrier was there's no problem, my water looks fine, why would I test it? So the thing that gets people in the door to monitoring their system is problem perception. However, it's very uncertain whether our ability to perceive water quality problems is tied to actual water quality. So that's the question we're going to deal with here. Are concentrations of contaminants actually related to human perceptions of quality? And luckily, I have a fantastic kind of community partner. I work with a statewide cooperative extension effort. So Virginia Tech is a land-grant university, so cooperative extension aims to provide services from the university to the state. And it's been running since 1989, and the goal, it's called the Virginia Household Water Quality Program, is to provide both low-cost water quality testing and also education on system maintenance to private system owners. It's served over 17,000 clients since it began. The great thing for me in looking at this issue is that homeowners who submit their samples, and these are all volunteers, they go and advertise via, the radio, now via the internet and social media, the health office, through extension. So volunteer homeowners, when they submit their water quality sample for analysis, also fill out a short questionnaire where they detail the characteristics of their system, how old is their well, do they have treatment, and the demographics of the household and their perceptions of water quality in the surrounding environment. So when I began working with this group, this was great. We had this amazing historical data set. Some of it was stored in some dusty cabinets that we had to dig up from the basement, but it's proved a really a wealth of information. So what I'm going to do, now they test for, it depends on the year, anywhere between 10 and 15 different water quality constituents. So I'm just going to give you two examples rather than keep you here all day. So I'm going to look at a contaminants of human health concern that would not generally, we would not assume would be associated with perception, and one that we would hope would be. So first, we're going to look at comparison to MCLs. These are maximum contaminant levels. They're set forth by the Safe Drinking Water Act. So these are designed for municipal systems, but we're using them as a benchmark for private systems because there are no official regulations for private systems. So the MCLs that we test for are total coliforms, E. coli, nitrate, and fluoride. We'll talk about sodium at the end. That's kind of a separate thing. And if you look here, the highest violations are for total coliform and E. coli. Both of these are classified as indicator bacteria. However, there are some important differences. Total coliforms are kind of a sentinel of system breakdown. So it means there's a pathway from the surface to the system. Coliforms may be associated with fecal contamination, or they can be just environmental constituents. E. coli, in contrast, is considered very specific for fecal contamination. So about 1 in 10 homes positive for E. coli and over 40% positive for total coliform. That may seem like a lot. That's very common across the United States. We also had high levels of sodium, but you'll notice I have a little kind of asterisk here. This is not an MCL. This is the current EPA guidance level. There's no MCL for sodium. And even though these values look kind of scary, there's been argument that the sodium recommended standard of less than 20 milligrams per liter is too low to begin with. Also, some treatment systems add sodium as a way to remove unwanted ions. So if you're treating for hardness or iron, you're actually adding salt to your system. So it's a very biased data set, and hopefully we'll get some more time to dig into that, and I'll tell you about that more about that next year. But so we're going to look at indicator bacteria because they're our main problem children. So linking to perceptions of water quality. If we look at those samples that were submitted that were positive for total coliforms, and we look at whether people said that the water had an unpleasant taste, an objectionable odor, and a natural color, staining or visible particles, we can see in most cases that people did not perceive a problem. In fact, 42% of homeowners had no negative perception of water quality, even though their sample was positive for total coliforms, and so it would be in violation of the Safe Drinking Water Act. Staining was a little high, and I'll get into that in a bit. But I want to say if you go to E. coli, which again is indicative of fecal pollution, so we would consider this a pretty serious health risk, 42% of homeowners, no negative perception of quality. They thought their water was just fine. Now, if we look at this a little deeper and we actually look at odds ratios, so looking at whether homeowners who perceive a water quality problem are more likely to have bacteria-positive samples than those who perceive no problem at all, we can see, so an odds ratio, just to remind you all, if it was above 1, we would assume that that meant that it was indicative. If you perceived a problem, you were more likely to have total coliform contamination. For the most part, things kind of hang out around 1. For E. coli, color and particles are associated with a little more risk. The thing that stands out is that we have a much higher odds ratio for total coliform with respect to staining. So it's over 4. So homeowners who see staining, so they have a stain on their tubs and their clothes, those homeowners are more likely to have a total coliform sample. Now, in some ways, this makes no sense because they're microorganisms because you can't see them. You certainly can't taste them or smell them. Why would this be so? If you remember, total coliforms are indicative of a break in the system. So if you have a break in the system, you have other constituents that get in. And we think that this is related to iron. Iron is the primary constituent that gets people up in arms with respect to staining. If you have a break in the system, you can allow iron particles into the system. You also can allow in iron-reducing bacteria. So it's a case where it's not the total coliform causing the stain, it's something else, but they're co-related. The problem is, if you go to address this issue, if you go to address the staining issue, you'll install treatment that has nothing to do with total coliform. You're not going to install disinfection to create, to prevent staining. So it's kind of an imperfect way to motivate monitoring. So switching to look at secondary MCLs from the Safe Drinking Water Act, these are constituents that are associated with aesthetic issues, so taste and odor problems. And so our main contaminant, although it's really just a quality of your water, is pH. About a third of homes have low pH. If we look at something like copper, 14% of homes had values greater than 1 milligram per liter. The reason we want to look at copper as an example is that copper is associated with a very characteristic perceivable problem. If you have high copper, you tend to have this characteristic blue-green stain. It's not showing up so great on the projection, but that would be in your sink or your tub. So definite, unlike bacteria, where we know you can't perceive bacteria, we would expect homeowners would be able to perceive copper. However, the results are very similar. If we look at the samples where we have copper values above the SMCL, 43% of homeowners have no perception of quality. The number that recognized there being a staining problem was very similar to that with bacteria. Again, when we get into odds ratios, we have a slight tiny bit above one for staining and particles and taste, but not overwhelming. So what's the take home? Well, the first take home is that just in general, in terms of domestic water supplies, it's important not to forget private system issues. Contamination with fecal indicator bacteria is the most prevalent cause of violating Safe Drinking Water Act standards in private systems in Virginia. This is constant basically throughout the United States. In fact, people just kind of shrug their shoulders who are involved in the industry because everyone's well is positive for E. coli, which is kind of depressing. But the interesting thing is that human perception really does not appear to be linked clearly with water quality. So there are a lot of cases where you could have a problem related to aesthetics or a serious health risk, and homeowners would not perceive it, and then therefore, given the other research, we would assume that they would choose not to go have their water tested or take any maintenance actions. So, and this appears to be across the board. So really what's needed is we need more research. And this study was all volunteers, so it would be great if we could start getting into the people who don't even, when given, you know, when really pushed by public health messaging and by low-cost water quality testing, the volunteers in this cohort, they really wanted to get their water tested if we reached out even farther, and to understand barriers to private system stewardship. Because like I said, you know, you remove cost, that doesn't seem to be all of it. Perception alone is not going to get the people who need to be taking care of their water through the door to actually follow monitoring requirements. So I just want to acknowledge my partners, the Cooperative Extension partners, Brian Benham and Aaron Ling. I have a myriad of students who have helped me. We're sponsored by USDA's Rural Health Education Program and the Virginia Tech College of Ag and Life Sciences. And I want to put in a shameless plug that I have. If you're interested in this and domestic water quality issues, I have a doctoral student who's presenting in this room tomorrow, 8:50 a.m., on lead exposure in private drinking water systems. So she'll be talking about issues of perception. You also might be interested if you are interested in urban-rural disparities.
Is there a question or two for Leanne?
Yeah.
In the back, and then we'll come to the front.
Yes. So I was dealing with a historical database that they began collecting this data long before when I was in grade school. But We have since 2012, we've expanded our questionnaire to include self-reported incidents of diarrhea and vomiting. We have a paper out that includes part of that. We have not found any link between
E. coli positive samples and incidents of gastrointestinal disease. And in some ways that's disappointing. It might not be surprising because, you know, whether or not there can be fluctuations in whether a sample is positive for E. coli, you can have regional people kind of develop immunity. We hear a lot of people say they come to get their water tested because they don't have any problem, but they have visitors come from out of town who suddenly come home, come down with some gastrointestinal disease. So it's kind of a difficult thing to get at.
And here in the front.